You're listening to the Electric Sheep Magazine podcast. I'm Alex Fitch, and in this episode, I'm talking to anime and manga expert Helen McCarthy, author of 500 Essential Anime Movies, Hayao Miyazaki, Master of Japanese Animation, and the Anime Movie Guide. Helen has curated a special season at the Barbican Centre in London, which celebrates the work of manga and Japanese animation pioneer Osamu Tezuka, creator of Astro Boy, Blackjack, and Kimba the White Lion, and is on from the 18th of September until the 14th, with screenings of short films, features, and talks. Also in this podcast, actress and comedian Jessica Foster Q will be reviewing a couple of recent releases in the cinema and on DVD, but first you'll hear some of my discussion with Helen about the anime work of Tezuka. Our interview was recorded in front of the Streatham Library Graphic Novels Readers Group and members of the public at, not surprisingly, Streatham Library. And before we talked, Helen and I watched with the audience a short experimental film by Osamu Tezuka called The Drop.
And the style of the cartoons is very different to his manga. Mm-hmm. It seems very much kind of a 60s style. If you look at, say, Disney cartoons at the time, like The Aristocats mm-hmm. and 101 Dalmatians, they all have this slightly kind of flatter animation yeah. that's very much kind of calligraphic and hard lines. Yes. And he seems to be responding to that as well.
Well, it's very much the graphic style of the time. I mean, if you look over a wide range of graphics, over fabric design, furniture design, graphic design in general, there is very much a kind of spirit that runs through it. And Tezuka was part of that world current in the same way that a huge number of other artists were.
And these short cartoons, where would they have been shown?
Most of them were made for festivals or as calling cards. I mean, obviously, success on the festival circuit is a good thing for an animator because it shows that you can finish a piece of work and it shows what kind of quality you're likely to be able to deliver. So Tezuka went on making shorts. And in fact, I think that if he'd made nothing but his short films, he would still have had a considerable international reputation as an animator. But as time went on, his short films got to be more and more of an indulgence and less of a part of the career.
And when you say it was a calling card, when did anime become big in Japan, both in sort of the cinema and on TV?
Anime really boomed when TV arrived. Anime was big in Japan before that. Toydoga made animated classics, cartoon films for children. Beautifully made, expensively produced, gorgeously filmed. No problem. That was great. But the point is, they made two or three a year. And kids would get taken to them at holiday times, and it would be a big treat to go to the cinema. The Hayao Miyazaki model of child film going, let them only see one a year and make it a good one. But Tezuka looked at how TV was spreading throughout Japan, and he looked at the cartoons that he saw coming from America, from Hanna-Barbera, from the studios, making the cheap end of the market. And an old friend of his, Shinichi Sakai, said to him, you know, we could do that. We could make Japanese content that was cheap and fast for TV, and then we could sell it back to America. And Tezuka was wholly in agreement with that idea, and so he made Astro Boy specifically with the aim of selling it to America, and did so enormously successfully.
How long was the gap between it first being shown in Japan and translated?
Exactly 6 months.
Wow.
It was screened on New Year's Day 1963 in Japan, hit the American airwaves at the end of June 1963.
So, I mean, we think of anime being translated into, you know, English into American. It's a fairly recent phenomenon, but presumably there was such an appetite for cartoons in America at the time that they were just looking for anything that they could show that they could redub with American voices.
Absolutely, and of course animation lends itself beautifully to that, particularly very limited cheap animation, because you don't have to worry so much about lip syncing. Cheap TV animation is a godsend to anyone who wants to dub cheap product. And Tezuka was fortunate, and the American industry was fortunate, in that they had a guy called Fred Ladd, who was running a studio that could dub and turn around cartoons very quickly. And Ladd understood what the American audience would and wouldn't take. Many people have vilified Fred Ladd for the amount of material that he hacked out of Astro Boy and of other cartoons. But you have to remember, he was working with his time. He was working at a time when the mass audience in America was not as sophisticated as it is today and would not have responded well. I sat and watched the first episode of the 81 series of Astro Boy, considerably after the first one, the Japanese one, and the first episode of the American one. And the first episode of the American one is actually the first, second, and a few fragments of the third episode of the Japanese one, because they took out so much material to render it acceptable to an American audience. So Fred Ladd really had quite a tough job mediating anime for a 1960s American audience. And he did it, you know, that he did it remarkably well is shown by the fact that people still watch Astro Boy and still love Astro Boy, and that many, many Americans who until 2 or 3 years ago had never heard of anime would tell you it was their favorite cartoon.
Why do you think people didn't appreciate that these cartoons are actually coming from Japan, that they put them in a different category? Oh, it's just, you know, TV animation for kids.
Well, you don't know, do you? I mean, if you saw that with no Japanese on it, you wouldn't know where in the world that had been made. Unless you were a real animation buff, you wouldn't particularly pick that out as a Japanese film. In just the same way you might see a beautiful Polish film with nothing to tell you it's Polish, do you know? Could you identify?
Some of this Eastern European animation.
Yeah, fair enough. And Film Board of Canada, you generally spot anywhere 1,000 miles off because it involves the celluloid being scratched. But generally,
but things
speaking,
like Astro Boy, though, very much had a look that looks like classic Japanese animation to us.
It
now.
Does now. But back then, it looked exactly like American animation because American animation wasn't that well established. TV hadn't been going in America that long. When you turn on the TV in America or the United Arab Republic or France and see animation there in your language, that's what you think is American or French or Arab animation. There are an awful lot of people in the Gulf who think that Astro Boy is Arab. Absolutely.
In terms of his output, what was the balance between animation and manga in the 60s?
There wasn't any. Okay. He did them both full-time, 24 hours a day.
Wow.
Tezuka was a phenomenal worker. I mean, his work rate was quite insane. I did some maths based on the figures that Tezuka Productions have verified for his lifetime. Assuming that he started work as he did at age 17 and worked until the day before his death at age 60, he had to produce 10 pages of finished manga every day. Every day. He also had to produce 20 pages of animation script every day. Plus, he had to run his studio, do his advertising, do all his other business interests, and somehow or other find time to see his family. Luckily, his studio for most of his working life was next door to his house, which must have been enormously convenient, because otherwise his kids just wouldn't have recognized him. But he had a phenomenal work rate, and the other thing was he was an appalling businessman. He was a truly dreadful businessman. I mean, many artistic geniuses are. And Tezuka managed to make huge fortunes in manga. In 1961, he earned 9.125 million yen.
What's that in?
In money, that was about $3 million then. $3 million in the 60s. And he spent it all. Animation. He always said...
So he really was the George Lucas of his
time. Oh yeah. He said, manga's my wife and animation's my mistress. And people think that means how he feels about it. But it's not that. You have to see it in a Japanese context. In a Japanese context, you love your wife and your mistress in entirely separate and absolutely equal ways. But your wife is the person who keeps the house running and manages the family finances so that you have money to spend on your mistress. That's her role. You know, seriously, that was a commonly accepted Japanese well-to-do woman's role until well into the last half of the 20th century. And that was, Tezuka's animation was the one that kept spending the money. And Tezuka's manga was the one who kept somehow or other coming up with something to balance the book so that the money was there to make the animation. And really, I can't think of any other person in the world of art, apart from possibly Picasso, could have pulled that off. Because the amount of energy it takes is just phenomenal.
Although Picasso was trading on his name after about 20 years.
He was still producing quite a lot of art.
Oh, I know, but it was rubbish.
Well, be fair, it takes about the same amount of time to produce a piece of rubbish Picasso as to produce a piece of good Picasso, given the way he worked. And to be honest, I think that our generation, having Damien Hirst, can't afford to cast the first stone. There is a very, very small exhibition at Barbican. Tezuka Productions have a touring exhibition which they've put together, which is 8 or 9 panels on which they tell the story of Tezuka's development as an artist in the context of Japan's manga development. So we've got those, and we've also got about a dozen examples of his work. Now, his actual work very rarely leaves Japan. I think they would send it out for the British Museum or the V&A, but they won't for the Barbican. But these are very high-quality signed prints of his work. So we've got prints that he's personally approved and signed and that have been struck by him. And it's a small exhibition, but it's a very nice exhibition because it gives you the whole context of Tezuka's manga work alongside his animation, which is very interesting. We've got a little bit of merchandise and a little bit of publishing in there, so you can really get a quick snapshot of the whole of Tezuka's career as a fine art animator, as a commercial animator, as a movie animator, and as a manga artist, and as a generator of merchandise, all in one place. And of course, we will also have on Saturday a really remarkable program in which three of the most influential talents in anime and manga in Britain, namely me, Paul, and Jonathan Clements, are going to do a panel on Tezuka, and you'll have the opportunity to actually see live footage of him in a film called The Film Is Alive, which we've made as a tribute to him, and see one of his most distinguished works on the same bill. So you get three very intelligent speakers. Thank you. One live-action Tezuka film and one Tezuka animation all on one bill. So that'll be a good one. Don't miss that. We must talk about Kamishibai. It actually means paper theatre. Really simple. And if you think of a sort of cross between, you know those Victorian theatres where you push little cutouts on, and Punch and Judy? It's kind of like that. Kamishibai evolved in the 1910s, around the same time anime evolved. And essentially, it was a selling tool for sweets. Guys would go around little villages with sweets and snacks on a bike, on a push bike. And when they got to the village or the town square or the Tokyo suburb, they'd knock these two wooden clappers together. And everybody would come rushing out because they'd know they were there with snacks. Obviously kids, but also adults. And in order to lure them out every time, the Kamishibai man would sell his snacks and then he'd say, okay, you're all my good customers, I'm going to tell you a story. Kids would know what was coming. And he would unfold this little desk, which is a small wooden frame, and put in a pile of bits of paper with painting on them. And by pulling out the papers one at a time so you could see the different pictures, as he told and performed the story, he would give you such a thrilling, cliffhanging performance. And of course, it was always a serial. So he could say, I'm back next week, come and buy some more sweets, I'll tell you more. Kamishibai was so popular in Japan that when telly started to come in, people called it Electric Kamishibai. And of course, telly practically killed Kamishibai. But it was a wonderful performance art because it could be taken around. All you needed was a bike and a suitcase. You could take it anywhere. It was performed right through the war. It was performed in bomb shelters in Tokyo with air raids going on overhead to distract frightened children and frightened people. It was performed in buildings that had been completely leveled by bombing. People heard the clappers and they just came out of whatever shelter they had and the kids could sit down for half an hour and watch Kamishibai. It went through a slump with television as entertainment moved off the street and into the home, but it went through something of a revival. Around the mid-70s, the Japanese, like a lot of other developed countries, started to realize that in their rush to modernize, they'd run the risk of throwing out a lot of cultural babies with the bathwater. And they started looking at the Kamishibai performers who were still working in elementary schools because it's a great teaching tool. And they thought, okay, this is a cultural property, we'll encourage it. So local festivals began to get grants for Kamishibai performers. The performers who'd kept working were able to take on apprentices and train them. And now you're seeing quite a revival of Kamishibai. The Kyoto International Manga Museum has a regular Kamishibai slot. And we're really lucky in London because the first ever professional Kamishibai tour of Britain is starting on Wednesday. And on the 23rd, we're bringing it to the Barbican as part of the Tezuka Festival. We were so lucky that the dates coincided. Tezuka watched Kamishibai as a kid. All Japanese kids watched Kamishibai as a kid at that era. Tezuka's artistic background wasn't just European films and American cartoons. It was Japanese culture. And for the very first time in London, we're going to have the chance to watch anime alongside one of the arts that influenced its development. So I think watch it. Unfortunately, the Kamishibai tickets are quite restricted. Because it's a performance art, you can't do it on a flat stage in a flat auditorium. It's in a fairly small, fairly intimate venue. But I would urge you, especially if you're interested in theatre and performance, to have a look at it, because it's a wonderful art form. And if this tour does well enough, it's only 5 dates all over Britain. If this tour does well enough, maybe we can get them back next year to do something a bit more extensive.
Tezuka is being introduced to modern generation, Metropolis.
Oh, yeah.
My favourite anime film.
This is wonderful. The score for Metropolis is just beautiful.
Well, the fact that it has like the apocalyptic scene is accompanied by a gospel song by Ray Charles.
Yes.
Just brilliant counterpoint.
Yeah. It's the destruction of the city. I can't stop loving you plays over it. Not my favourite, but pretty close. It's up there. In fact, I've got a new book out at the moment, which is 500 Essential Anime Movies, Obligatory Commercial. It's from AliExpress, and it's a fun book, because although they made me stick to short series and features, so I had to leave out a lot of things that I really love that are long series, I got to write lists of top tens, and Metropolis is in one of my top 10 lists, as well as the great movies. The other fun thing about it is they spent an absolute fortune on doing tons of colour pictures. Colour pictures on every page.
We'll return to my talk with Helen in a bit, where in response to a question from the audience, we're looking at the controversial subject of erotic anime. However, before that, we have a couple of reviews of recent releases by Jessica Fostercue.
Eden Lake was previewed at Fright Fest and goes on general release on the 12th of September. The writer-director, James Watkins, introduced the world premiere of this film by saying that Empire had described it not as something you watch, but more as something you survive. Well, indeed. Just recalling the film, I'm nauseous. It left me impressed but reeling. James Watkins has written Gone and The Descent 2, and the film is certainly heavily influenced by The Descent in terms of pace, imagery, and the relentless bombardment of ill-fated gory turns. Labelled as a hoodie horror, gornography is also fitting. It's not quite Wolf Creek or Switchblade Romance in terms of unyielding tension and revulsion, but it's really not far off, and the intent is certainly there. Tapping into our ever-increasing fear of hoodies is a novel and quite brilliant idea. The media have driven a panicked frenzy over youth violence and knife crime, highlighting the proliferation of an underclass without hope whose children and grandchildren are so broken through abuse and circumstance that the ruthlessness and extremity of their violence, especially gang violence, is out of control. Its perpetrators are increasingly young and it's growing in brutality. Saying this, the nature of the media attention on the subject is mostly hyperbolic demonisation and designed to necessarily increase fear and prejudice, as opposed to intelligently analysing the phenomenon. We're controlled through fear, and a film raising the issue in the way that it does can only really serve to increase this fear. There is a tasteless mass snobbery in the tabloid exposure of hoodie violence, of which the frequent use of the word chav in the press is indicative. This pitfall, at least, is cleverly and tactfully avoided by Eden Lake. Kelly Riley and Michael Fassbinder play Jenny and Steve, a well-to-do, upper-middle-class, city couple who go to a flooded quarry for a romantic weekend. Steve is a relatively neutral character. Gaining favour with his conservationist views, he's chosen Eden Lake to propose to Jenny because shortly it will be ruined by construction giants who are building luxury apartments around the lake. This goes a little way to explaining the locals' resentment of rich city types turning up to holiday and now eventually buy out what they essentially believe to be their territory. Steve and Jenny's arrival in the area is an excellent sequence of scenes. Riley's saccharine but sexy portrayal of Jenny, a sweet and pouted primary school teacher, is suitably irritating. It is great that Jenny and Steve are not entirely likeable characters, yet their abject rejection by this community is really unsettling. It could easily be likened to a contemporary Wicker Man scenario. Once the teenager's reign of bloody terror on this couple starts, however, it resonates that you weren't entirely convinced where your sympathies had lay at the start of the film. There are outstandingly strong performances from the teenage cast, most notably from Thomas Turgoose as Cooper, a minion-turned-monster. Before his star turn in Shane Meadows' This Is England, he had no intention of becoming an actor, having to be bribed to the audition with a fiver. This is great news for British cinema. He has more natural talent than the entire adolescent cast of Harry Potter combined. Equally, Jack O'Connell stands out as Brett, the gang's tyrannical and frankly psychopathic leader. This is a terrifying film with some moments of genius. I hadn't been this scared by any other film in the past year. Saying this, a momentous opportunity is missed to make this a truly thought-provoking film had the teenagers' backgrounds been explored. As it is, the film raises the issue of hoodie violence, but as I've said, can only serve to add tension and increase fears. Taken, however, as just the horror film that Eden Lake is, this is a brilliant, stomach-turning and truly horrible film, which almost certainly achieves everything it does set out to. It plays on our most reality-based nightmares. Annie Leibovitz, Life Through a Lens. Leibovitz's work spans decades, and here it is charted from its very beginning. Originally, and up until finishing art school in San Francisco, Leibovitz had wanted to be a painter. Then came photography and a lifetime's career in itself, working for Rolling Stone magazine, where the first of her most iconic photographs were taken. Now Leibovitz works seemingly without financial constraint for commercial fashion-based publications such as Vanity Fair and Vogue. I have no particular interest in fashion, but these photographs are so artful that one has to appreciate the form. The documentary moves seamlessly between shadowing Annie's working day and more formal interviews with some colourful characters that she has worked with and known throughout her career. The interviewees, such as Hillary Clinton and Mick Jagger, provide much of the film's insight, intimacy and moreover wit. Whoopi Goldberg discusses the famous picture which Leibovitz took of her in the 1980s, in which she emerges naked from a bath of milk. She explains Annie's intention to show a black woman reaching out of what was still essentially a white world, mainstream comedy. She admits happily that this image brought her instant recognition. Later, this interview is revisited, and Goldberg hilariously admits to the milk being disgusting. She stank. She says that cats followed her for days. Equally brilliant is Keith Richards being shown some of Leibovitz's most popular photographs of him during her days touring with the Rolling Stones. He was, and is, so frazzled that he can't recall a single one of them being taken. Director Barbara Leibovitz, the youngest of Annie's sisters, doesn't shirk from exposing the full extent of her drug addiction and essentially her descent into a fully blown rock and roll lifestyle. After all, when you're working day to day with the likes of Hunter S. Thompson and it's the 1960s, what do you expect? Her swift first and last time recovery is made to look a little easy. Overall, one gets the impression, however, that Leibovitz has led a relatively private life, and the frankness with which she talks of her family and her years of experimentation make the audience feel all the more privileged. Equally, the sensitivity with which Leibovitz's lifelong relationship with cult status intellectual Susan Sontag endows you with the sense that you're being let in on a secret, and certainly for me elicited a genuine emotional response. James Newton Howard and Gailey Schoen do a superb job with the music, which, although varied, makes itself noted only when required. There is a fair amount of scepticism about Leibovitz, which makes her approach all the more appealing. Despite her success, she still appreciates the simplicity of photography as an art form, shunning clichés with the firm belief that it's not possible to actually capture somebody in a photograph. It's as much chance as anything else when you shoot a picture in that fraction of a second when people are really looking like themselves. In the same breath, it's refreshing that fashion culture hasn't led to an unnecessary reverence of fame. She describes photography now as a shabby culture because of the nature of celebrity, and rightly so, in my opinion. This is a neat and powerful film which deserves a broader release than it has at present, a must for anyone even faintly interested in photography. Annie Leibovitz's Life Through a Lens is released on DVD on the 22nd of September.
Next, we're returning to my discussion with anime expert Helen McCarthy. And in response to a question from the audience, we're looking at the controversial subject of erotic anime.
Erotic manga movies come out enormously regularly. Although there are lots of erotic movies out there. Pornography is about 10% of every film industry in the world. I mean, they've always made them. They've always been part of the Japanese industry. It's just that the Japanese think they're a very little niche market. And they're amazed that we find them so interesting. They're thinking, you know, why are all these British people buying our pornography? I mean, only sad geeks buy anime pornography in Japan. And over here, they're a big slice of the market. So that probably says more about us than it does about the Japanese. I'm sure that somewhere there's a studio where they're sitting scratching their heads and thinking, how can we make this Japanese porn, but not in Japan? Can we do it cheaper?
Well, speaking as the co-writer of the erotic anime movie guy, What was your number one choice in that book?
My number one choice for positive or negative reasons.
Just as a good movie.
As a good movie, that's quite difficult because an erotic movie and a good movie are not necessarily things that overlap.
They shouldn't be mutually exclusive.
My personal favourite erotic movie is one that sadly you can't get in Britain now. which is The Sensualist. Absolutely beautiful film, made as a piece of fine art. They were doing things like taking 200-year-old textiles and pressing them onto the wet paint of the cells to get textures, picking leaves and putting them on the cells to try and pick up shadows. Gorgeous movie, based on a 16th century erotic novel about a very rich young man who decides to spend all his dad's money going around brothels and tea houses and really having a whale of a time, and does exactly that. And it's a perfect combination of Japanese erotic literature and really beautiful art and remarkable animation. And the worst erotic movie I have ever seen is The Gigolo, which is considerably less interesting than watching paint dry. Actually, if you're looking for erotic drawing, there's an awful lot more in most of the Ghost in the Shell franchises than in any erotica. I mean, I don't know how they get away with the certificates they get for most of the drawings of Motoko Kusanagi. Perhaps because it's supposed to be a robot body, they think we can be more erotic there. But that is extremely sensual artwork. And it's not in pornography. Cleopatra, which we're showing at the Barbican, is...
On what day? At what time?
Oh, goodness me. You have to look at the website. That's what websites are for. Oh, he's got it.
Cleopatra.
Cleopatra, which was sold in America as Cleopatra, Queen of Sex. But contrary to popular opinion, contains very little sex.
It's an 18.
It has to be an 18 because of the title. But the other thing about Cleopatra is that contrary to the myth that's been running around American fandom for years, it didn't get an X certificate in America. It was never submitted for certification, specifically because the distributors were worried that it wouldn't get an X certificate in America, thus blowing their marketing campaign. So, but that has the most wonderfully silly slapstick sequences, a catalogue of all the major animation styles of world animation for about the past 20 years, plus cutout sequences that are so reminiscent of what Terry Gilliam did with Monty Python, but instead of using cutouts of Victorian advertising and old magazines, he's using cutouts from the great art galleries of the world. Mm. And when you see The Assassination of Caesar done as a note play, believe me, it gives you a whole new perspective on Shakespeare.
And that's showing on the 24th at 8:30 in the evening.
It's the last film in the season, and we thought it was quite appropriate that it should be that, because it's the first film that Jessica made specifically for an adult audience, the first long film. And by which he didn't mean an adult audience who want to see ladies in underwear and out of it, but an adult audience that wants to see a film that will make them think of it. All movies are censored in Britain. Yeah, everything's censored in Britain. And I mean, when Urotsuki Doji 4 went for its BBFC certificate, Urotsuki Doji 4, by the way, was only made because Urotsuki Doji 1 and 2 sold so well in Britain. They said, let's make 3 and 4, we'll do well with it. But Urotsuki Doji 4 was made for a Western audience specifically. And when the BBFC got their hands on it, they cut the 4-episode series down to 25 minutes. It just wasn't worth releasing.
But it's just the storyboards, isn't it?
Yeah, essentially. Yeah. It's Urotsuki Doji 4 is not that good. Although it is Toshio Maeda, so you've got to forgive it a certain amount. And it's very, very nasty in many ways, but it certainly doesn't deserve to be shredded to 25 minutes. Yeah. It loses just about everything. The script, the story, the characters, and definitely the interest.
For more info about Helen's season of Osamu Tezuka shorts, talks, and feature films at the Barbican, which is on from the 18th of September until the 24th, please go to www.barbican.org.uk. And for further info on Helen, please go to my blog at www.panelborders.wordpress.com, where you'll find a couple of other interviews with Helen, an episode of I'm Ready for My Close-Up, where I'm discussing the current state of anime with her, and a panel that she organised at this year's Bristol International Comics Expo, which is available as a couple of episodes of Panel Borders. As for buying the work of Osamu Tezuka on DVD in the UK, there's a meagre selection which includes episodes of Astro Boy and the anime feature films of Blackjack and Metropolis. To buy his series Kimber the White Lion, which influenced a certain Disney film, you'll have to go to a website that sells American DVDs. And to buy a collection of his short experimental anime, you'll have to import that from Australia, or find a specialist import shop. There's a partial transcript of my interview with Helen at www.electricsheepmagazine.com, where you'll also find an interview that Virginie Sellevy conducted with comic book artist Charles Burns, who has also seen his work recently adapted into animation in the form of the French portmanteau film Fears of the Dark. For more info about Jessica Fostercue and where you'll be able to see her perform stand-up and improv comedy live, please also visit my blog www.panelborders.wordpress.com. Thanks for listening.